Salutations, Mets fans, and welcome to this week's edition of Amazing Avenue Audio. Amazing Avenue Audio is the official podcast of your SB Nation New York Mets site, Amazing Avenue. As always, I'm your host, Jeffrey Paternostro, and with me, as usual in the co-host seat, is Rob Castellano. Rob, any new Revolutionary War era biographies to talk about this week?
The James Madison one is particularly thick, so we're going to be on that one for a while.
This is our off-season book of the book of the month club, book of the off-season club, probably.
I notice you're sounding a little more nasally than usual.
I am coming down with a cold, hence my current use of emergency hot toddy.
Ooh, okay, well, any excuse for an emergency hot toddy is probably a good one.
It is. But I have no honey in the house is the only problem there. No, it's my own fault. I partied a little too hard in the city this weekend. I did my usual thing where I go down to Football Factory because Sheffield Wednesdays was on TV this past weekend, which is happens about once a month or so. A bunch of us get together at 7 in the morning to watch the game and drink. And I stayed up a little too late. It was a little bit rainy, and I drank a little too much before 9 and sang a little too much because they beat Leeds 6-0. And make a long story short, I was getting a little hoarse at the end of the day, and I'm like, oh, I just sang a little too much and drank a little too much. And I woke up the next morning, I'm like, oh, I'm getting a cold. Great.
So for those of us in the unenlightened masses, we probably have covered this here, but I'm going to cover it again. Sheffield Wednesday is a soccer team.
Yes, association football. Yeah. If you want to be specific. Yeah, they're in the English League Championship side, which is the second division of English soccer right below the Premier League. And they were playing Leeds United, who's one of their traditional rivals, and a right bag of jerks for the most part.
Did they win?
They did. They beat them 6-0, which I think is the first time they've won 6-0 since like 1950 or something.
Wow, that's a good day.
Yeah, it was a good day. There's a lot of singing. There's a lot of drinking. And one of the nice things they did, right before Christmas, the team, I guess they had somebody in New York for some reason, or I don't know if he made a special trip, I doubt it, but they dropped off at the bar we meet at Football Factory in Legends. They, like, dropped off, like, a bunch of Christmas presents for the group. So those all got given out.
And I was about to ask how you became a fan of the team, but I guess I no longer need to. Sound like a generous bunch of gentlemen.
No, this is the story that always comes up, because they're not... I mean, they were a good, decent side, and, like, I mean, they're a historically good side, I should say. But they haven't really been good since the early 90s. But there happened to be a first division. This was pre-Premier League, so it been like late 80s, early 90s. It was a first division recap show that I would watch Saturday morning before I'd go bowling. This just happened to be on, like, it was on Sports Channel, which was the Mets cable station at the time. They also showed Australian, usually it was a first division recap show, and then if we were late getting out of there, I caught a little bit of Australian rules football. It's like one of those ESPN things, like early ESPN things, where they were just buying whatever programming they could get to fill time when they weren't showing Mets games.
And somehow it stuck.
Which is probably not one of the better decisions I made, but then again, I'm a Mets fan, and I'm still rooting for them, too. Actually, yeah, somebody, we were talking, it came up on Twitter where somebody asked me what they're starting to get into. I think it was Premier League football because you can watch all the games on NBC, NBC Sports, and online. They show every single game, which is pretty awesome. But he was looking for suggestions for what team to root for, like wondering like what the Mets equivalent is, and like why would you voluntarily want to root for the Mets equivalent of anything?
Yeah. Now we're about 5 minutes in, and we haven't hit on the episode number yet.
Yes, we should keep it moving. I could regale you all days with. I should say after they beat Leeds United 6-0 on Saturday. I was at work today. I sweated out their FA Cup replay with Macclesfield Town, which is three levels below them in Conference Premier. They ended up winning 4-1, but it was 1-1 late in the game. So it's the thing about Wednesday. You never know exactly what you're going to get.
Maybe I'm just completely like ignorant non-soccer fan here. 6-0 to me sounds like. If the Mets were to win, like, 35-0.
That's probably a bit of an exaggeration, but, like, it'd be like a 20-3 type game, probably. Like, it happens maybe once every couple years. You score, like, 15-20 runs and really drub someone.
And those are always fun games.
But it'll be the equivalent of beating, like, you know, not beating the Yankees. I mean, I guess it's kind of the equivalent of beating the Yankees. They have a few traditional rivals, Leeds United, Sheffield United, and Barnsley, I guess, would be the three major ones, the three sort of local rivals. So I guess Leeds United would be closest to the Yankees in this particular metaphor, since they are the more storied team. No, I mean, I guess they're not really that much more storied. It's tough to find. I mean, the Mets analog I always use is Queen's Park Rangers, which is like a London team that spends a lot on over-the-hill players. Sort of like those mid-90s Mets teams did. But there's no great... I mean, there's plenty of soccer teams that are broke, don't get me wrong, but there's no great analog for the Mets.
In very few phases of life can you find a good...
It's true.
...comparable anything to the Mets.
So this is episode 49. This is not a soccer podcast. You have not stumbled on the wrong dial. Do not adjust your dial. It's episode 49, the John Neese edition, because although we can make for a case for Armando Benitez, nobody really wants this to be the Armando Benitez episode.
Like we hit on before we hit record here, Benitez gets, you know, he gets his fair share of ill repute, but he was a decent Met for a couple of years. More than a decent Met. He was a good Met for a couple of years.
Yes, his failures were certainly more high profile than his successes was his issue. Which, I mean, is going to be true whenever you're a closer. I mean, Billy Wagner was quite a good closer for the Mets, but we remember, you know, So Taguchi just wearing him out in the NLCS more than we remember his good work in the regular season.
Yeah, it's tough when you consistently blow games in the NLCS to really be fondly remembered by a fan base.
Actually, I am fond of Billy Wagner, if only because I reuse his fucking shocker quote at every possible opportunity.
Spurred by none other than L. Mills.
Wasn't that no? That was when everyone. That was when the whole thing with Wagner's issue was the Hispanic players weren't staying to.
Oh, right.
Yeah, it wasn't an L-Mills thing.
You're right. I'm mixing up the Know Your Place Rook.
Yes, that was the L-Mills. Also, not as versatile as fucking Shocker, but still definitely meme-worthy at times.
Yeah, so Benitez definitely lacked that quotability that Wagner had. That just, like, shockingly insensitive quotability. Another reason to dislike Benitez.
It's true. And if you're a closer, if you're going to blow games, you better at least be a good quote. Or be Australian like Grant Balfour, and then you can do whatever you want.
Yeah.
So John Neese it is. This is the last sort of, I think, good number for a while, but... I mean, 99, obviously. I'm looking forward to that, but...
We got a ways to go. A lot of slogging to do through some bad numbers here.
So the agenda for episode 49, again, not much has happened in Metsland over the past week. So as we've been doing the last few weeks, I've actually named this segment. We're going to give the segment a name where we sort of glide over the little stories, the little capsule reviews. I'm calling it Slow News Week. So we'll kick off with Slow News Week, and then we'll answer your emails. We got a few emails again this week. We're starting to sort of settle into like a nice little 4 to 7 email a week range, which is maybe a little higher on the high side, but acceptable. As long as we don't take 2 weeks off and get like 10 like we did last time, we're fine. But again, it's an interesting crop of emails. A lot of variety. I like that. It's nothing about shortstops, so keep up the good work, guys. So we're going to start with this week in Mets Twitter for Slow News Week. Brian Bannister is on Twitter, Rob. I'm very excited about this.
I was unaware.
Yes, I think it's actually Brian Bannister, because I don't know why you would go to the trouble to set up a fake Brian Bannister account, though I could say the same thing about Fernando Tatis.
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of the defining feature of a fake Twitter account, is that, like, you don't choose the big name. You choose, like, the Fernando Tatis, just so that people like you and I say, well, why would they choose Fernando Tatis or Brian Bannister?
It does seem legit, as far as I can tell. Like, there's an actual link to his photography studio in the in the Twitter bio. It's at Real Banny. So we'll see how that goes. I'm already following him. I'm very excited about that, though.
Also, it has real in the name, so that means it must be,
obviously, it's actually Brian. That's how you know. You wouldn't, like, make that up.
You don't want to misrepresent.
No. We'll wait till he gets the blue check mark to be sure. The other thing I learned on Twitter this week is that, I don't know why this, like, tickled me at the time. I follow a lot of Mets prospects and Mets players on Twitter, obviously. It's kind of a necessary thing, though it's more chaff than wheat a lot of the time, unless you're a big fan of Call of Duty or Chipotle. But you get a lot of tweets about whatever TV show they're watching, whether it's Breaking Bad or Duck Dynasty was really popular this past season with a bunch of them. But Zach Wheeler tweeted out this week that he was really excited about the premiere of Shameless, which I thought was like an interesting choice.
Hmm. Yeah. I do not watch it myself, but I've heard really good things. So I'll give him a nod for that one.
Maybe he's just a big William H. Macy fan, which is fair.
Or it could be noted Kevin Burkhart guest. What's her name?
I know who you're talking about.
Who had that like sort of weird, awkward interview with him midway this year.
They didn't. It was actually a promotion for the show, wasn't it? Or was she in a film? I don't even remember anymore.
The question is, how long will we go without mentioning her name?
Because neither of us can think of it. I could look this up. It probably won't.
I'll take it. You continue.
Okay. More Twitter news. I don't even know why I'm including this, but again, it's basically because it amused me. Matt Harvey had some Twitter trolls about his trip to Thailand.
and
he dispatched of them. The thing I like about him, the reason it tickled me, is Matt Harvey, for all his sort of, for all the sort of bro-y stuff that gets associated with him, whether it's the love of old school rap or the, magazine features of him partying with investment bankers, he seems to have a really kind of like deadpan sense of humor about him that comes through every once in a while. Most notably, I think in the Jimmy Fallon bit he did, but he just sort of, he handled it probably better than, as in a different way. I mean, he didn't just like point to the scoreboard as a lot of guys would. He actually was kind of funny about it, so I appreciated that. But really, stop. Why would you ever, like, I don't even think I've jokingly, I think I jokingly trolled Colin McHugh once about the weather in Binghamton. And that was my one.
Like Harvey did?
No, I don't even know if he responded to it. I also remember his wife tweeted at me, Adam Rubin, and Toby Hyde, because we were arguing about something related to Colin McHugh on Twitter, which was pretty amusing. But of course, we all know the famous, famously we talk about it constantly, or at least multiple times on the podcast, Justin Turner tweet to me, but I didn't actually troll him by name.
Yeah, that was more like a good catch on his part to spot you out and just...
If by good catch you mean he was Twitter searching for his own name immediately after a rehab game, then yes.
Exactly. Nothing gets by him.
Nothing gets by Justin Turner, as long as it's not a baseball hit on the ground to his right or left.
No, Harvey was good. That was... I have it here. He begins by just sort of like reveling in his awesome life.
It's a pretty awesome life, I mean.
It clearly is. And I mean, aside from just the fact that he's Matt Harvey, he's dating this Russian model, he's on vacation in Thailand, and so he's sort of like...
Every Met player is going to Southeast Asia this offseason.
And good for them. If I could, I would too. And so he summarizes by saying, "Nothing better than blasting music, relaxing in the most amazing, beautiful blue water, finding yourself in Thailand." When a Yankees fan has to just completely antagonize him, you have what, 19 career wins? Why on earth do you act like you're in the Hall of Fame? That's just...
I'd hate to see what he would have thought about Josh Satin riding an elephant.
Harvey responds, and I won't go through, there are numerous tweets here, but the best response that he could have given was, "No, I think I have 12 wins." Just enjoying life. Didn't know that was a problem. And it just evolves from there.
Yeah.
But I mean, that just sort of gives you the gist of Harvey's tone and just sort of the tenor he strikes. And it's definitely worth a read.
So that is this week in Mets Twitter. Next up, Mike Piazza didn't get into the Hall of Fame. That happened. I could definitely excoriate, just whip out the hottest of hot takes here, but he's going to get in eventually. I just don't have the energy.
Yeah, I mean, I think the best we can do is just point people to Dan Lewis's story that he had up on Amazing Avenue that exceptionally summarized the story of Mike Piazza and the steroid myth and sort of debunked the whole thing. So if you didn't read it, I would highly recommend you to go back and take a look. It's still only, 10 or 12 stories down on the front page timeline of Amazing Avenue.
As we said, it's a slow news week.
Yeah.
So some minor league news and notes this week as well. We're starting to see the field staffs for the minor league affiliates, at least for the full season ball, get rolled out. And it seems like a lot of return engagements. The one big promotion that's probably worth noting is Frank Viola will be the pitching coach in Las Vegas this year, taking Randy St. Clair's spot. I guess it's noteworthy in so much that if they were grooming him for a major league job, that would probably be the next move that they made. So it's interesting that he might be waiting in the wings for a major league gig if Dan Worthen is let go at some point.
Yeah, I don't know if that's what's happening here, but I certainly know that if I were Dan Worthen, I wouldn't be excited about that move.
Well, it could just be a move to keep him around too. After I mentioned it on Twitter, somebody tweeted at me that Rochester, I guess the Twins went after him pretty hard last year, and we're going to give him the Rochester gig.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, so this might just be a way to sort of keep him in the fold. He's done a really good job, and in the past, he's worked with Rafael Montero, Jacob deGrom. I suppose Logan Verrett could start there as well. So it gives him another look at those guys that kind of flourished under him in Savannah.
And aside from that, it gives him the chance to work with Noah Syndergaard.
Yeah, so he would be working with, the potential Mets starters of the future. Everything else was pretty much the same. Looks like the Binghamton field staff is entirely the same, actually. And we'll see who they get to replace Viola and Savannah. This will be the only move that is really yet to have been announced for the full season affiliates.
Yeah, I'm always curious to see what happens with Pedro Lopez, who's the manager in Binghamton. Is he sort of like a hot name in the Mets system right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think it'll be interesting to see what happens if some sort of major league coaching spot, whether it's, first base coach or bench coach, opens up after this year for whatever reason. Bob Guerin's going to get another gig or anything, but if you see like a major league coaching spot open up, what they'll do, if they'll give it to Lopez, or if that's sort of Backman's to lose.
Yeah, the whole thing, Backman, I mean, it's weird at this point, like where he's not going to get the manager job, and it's clearly what he wants. So, if third base opens up or the bench coach job opens up, does he take it? I don't even know.
I mean, think so, just because it gets you out of the PCL.
Yeah, he clearly doesn't.
I mean, a major league gig is a major league gig.
Yeah, he sort of, it's pretty clear that he went back with like his teeth gritted, like as a last resort.
And I mean, we give him a fair amount of shit on the podcast, but we give the contingent of Mets fans that are very stridently pro Wally a fair amount of shit on the podcast. But I mean, he's a good minor league manager. His players seem to like him. I don't even know how you evaluate those guys. We're just not qualified to do it. I guess I will point you again to Gabe Kapler's great piece of Baseball Prospectus from a couple months back, sort of looking at the major inefficiency in minor league coaches and minor league managers is how teams lean on guys with name value. Like, there's no reason to believe, based on the information we have, that Backman would be a better, you know, major league coach or major league manager than Pedro Lopez. But, you know, Pedro Lopez played 13 years in the minors, and Backman was on a World Series championship team. So those are sort of our abiding memories of the players. Yeah. If we have memories of Pedro Lopez at all.
Yeah, I don't think many of us do, but yeah, I mean, going back to Frank Viola, I mean, Phil Regan, the pitching coach at St. Lucie, has been sort of heralded within the Mets organization for a lot of years. But, you know, didn't take long for Frank Viola to hop right over him. And
Regan's also in his 70s, though. I think he's just sort of happy to – he's just a baseball lifer.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think there are reasons, ancillary reasons. I mean, I don't think he really aspires to a major league position, or, you know, much more than what he's really is an instructor at this point. He's sort of building up pitchers, not, you know, maintaining them at the major league level. But you know, it name value definitely does carry an inordinate amount of weight as far as minor league and major league coaches go. So it's not surprising that we continue to hear about Backman and, you know, the drama that continues to unfold there. But, right, it will be interesting to see what happens if such a role presents itself. Lopez is an interesting name. Backman obviously always is. I always wonder what happened to Ken Obergefell.
He was coaching in indie ball, I think, last I looked.
Yeah, I sort of feel
he bad. He might have had one of the WB, like one of the WBC teams, like one of the ones that was like in the qualifiers.
Yeah, I think
this past year or two.
It's sort of like a shocking decline for him. Like, he made a long, slow journey through the minors, finally joined the Mets major league field staff, and after a couple of tough years, not necessarily due to anything he was doing, he was let go and basically fell out of baseball and found himself in indie leagues.
Yeah, it's just weird. There's like a window for these kind of things. For how, I mean, I'm a little bit surprised he never got a gig. I think he still also pops up in winter league ball.
Oh yeah, he's always down. He's always down there.
So I mean, he's still, you know, grinding it out. So good for him.
Good for him. I don't know. I was gonna say bad for him.
You know, it's I'm of two minds of this. I think he wouldn't be doing it if he didn't still enjoy it. So good for him on that level. But I mean, it is kind of a look, at the end of the day, there's only 30 gigs. So it's what it comes, I mean, it's what it comes down to is there's only 30 jobs, and if you don't get the right interview or the right, you know, it's a lot of it's a lucky break. Like, I thought Chip Hale would have a major league job by now too.
Yeah, actually, another good name. I still think that he's going to pop up somewhere because he just, you know, he seemed like he was destined for that. Is he still the bench coach in Oakland?
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah.
I think he would have been a good fit for Seattle, but they went with he might have even interviewed there. I don't remember. But they, of course, went with Lloyd McClendon instead.
Digging up the retreads. The other tried and true strategy of baseball coaching.
The other major minor league news of the week is it's seeming more and more likely now that this will be the last year that the Mets minor league affiliate is in Savannah. And not just because their player development contract runs out at the end of the year, because it seems like that ownership group is going to move them to Columbia, South Carolina. Now, this doesn't mean they'll drop the Mets. The Mets were previously in Columbia with the Capital City Bombers, I think, directly before Savannah. They're going to, looks like they're going to build a new stadium in Columbia. And I like my trips to Savannah. I'm trying to make another one this year, and I feel kind of bad, but realistically, this is probably a good move for everyone involved, assuming it doesn't, you know, play as one of the best pitcher's park in the minors like Savannah does. And also, it just, as much as I like historic Grayson Stadium from an aesthetic point of view, it's probably not the greatest facility for your A-ball team to be playing in.
Yeah, I can only imagine what the locker room looks like.
And I guess staying with, well, minor league news of sorts, the Mets have announced who they'll be invited, the non-40-man invitees to spring training. No real surprises. The guys you'd expect, the sort of the guys that are playing for a roster spot like Carreño and Reed, and the big prospect names like Montero, Syndergaard, and Nimmo. But I thought I would pose this question to you, Rob. Of the guys currently not on the 40-man roster, and we'll throw out Reed and Carreño because they've got as good a shot of probably any other fringy bullpen on the. Actually, Reed's actually on the 40-man, I think, isn't he?
Yeah, I think he is, but I didn't see him on the invite list. I'm sure. He's on the 40-man, so
I think it just counted as non-roster invitees. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
But who do you think of the non 40-man invitees has the best shot of making the opening day roster?
Best shot. I have my guys that I'm most interested to watch. But the best shot. To be like really pragmatic and boring, I would say like maybe Taylor Teagarden.
That's pragmatic and boring.
Exactly.
You can't pick Taylor Teagarden or Carreño.
Yeah, let's sort of like defer to that. Who's the most interesting guy? Aside from like Syndergaard, Nimmo class, because the names that I'm watching for, I'm excited to see friend of the podcast Adam Kolarik.
Of course.
Lefty reliever.
So are you you're gonna be down in spring training this year?
It's still to be determined. I typically go last year. I didn't make it. It's always a scheduling.
Right. Yeah.
It's always a scheduling question. They typically schedule really nicely around some other stuff that I'm doing in February and early March, and last year didn't. So we're gonna see what happens this year. But yeah, it'd be cool to bump into him again. Always a favorite lefty reliever, pitched in Binghamton for most of the year, pitched really well. He posted a 1.70 ERA, so he's a guy who, I don't know that he'll necessarily break camp with the team or anything like that, but I think he could open some eyes as a big, strong lefty who throws pretty hard and he gets lefties out. Definitely a name that we could hear at least, midway through the season, and he can definitely start to solidify that status in camp. How about you? Any names that you're sort of excited to watch beyond like the Syndergaard Montero class?
I'm a little, intrigued. It's intrigued will be the word I'll use. See if I could see a guy sort of coming out of nowhere in spring, like Josh Edgen did a couple of years ago, for example. I might pick Corey Mazzoni. He's never quite been healthy. I don't know if they want to move him off being a starter this quickly. But I could see him be a guy that, in short bursts in spring training with a fresh arm, is touching 95, 96, showing you that split. I could see some really, gushing quotes from Terry Collins right around the end of February about Corey Mazzoni.
Yeah, because you always get those like couple of arms that really nobody knows yet, but they start to build their names for themselves in camp. Last year it was Montero.
Oh, yeah, Montero.
A little bit Hansel Robles as well. Guys that you or I might know, but the beat writers start to dig deep looking for stories and really pump these guys up. I could see that being Mazzoni this year.
Yeah. I think who else is a... I still have a soft spot for Logan Verrett. I don't know why. If he sat 90 to 92, he'd be a top 20, maybe top 15 prospect in the system. He just had a little bit more velocity. Because he's got the slider change. You look at the guys in that general range, the Mazzonis, the DeGroms, I guess even Sessa and Yanoa. The guys that are on a tier, but we'll keep Mats out of it. But the guys that are the tier below, Montero and Syndergaard, his secondary offerings are so much better than the rest of those guys. And part of it is he's more, he's a little bit older, he's more polished. But the slider and the change are legit solid major league offerings right now. Present day. He just had a little bit more fastball velocity, even a little bit more command. It's just, he's got such a thin margin for error with that fastball.
Yeah, no, the slider is the best secondary pitch of any of the guys you've named.
Yeah, probably. I like Mazzoni's split, but it's close.
Yeah, I mean, if only you could will a couple more miles per hour.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like, yeah, I still think he settles into a role as a pretty good reliever. Maybe he's more 90-92 in short bursts and just throws a million sliders, which is usually a formula for success. But he's definitely a guy, for whatever reason, I saw him a ton last year. That might be part of it. But you just get attached to these guys. You just see them all the time. And it's just
to validate all the trips out.
Yeah, there. It's just like, I need something. It's like, just give me something.
I'm hoping that Kevin Plawecki spends a while in camp just so we can see him.
He will, because he's a catcher. You always need catchers.
Yeah.
There'll be a million catchers in camp. There just always is.
I would love to see him get a couple at bats in the major league games.
I think he will, certainly. He'll get probably like split squad type stuff, but I think he'll get looks. I think he's a guy that the player development staff really likes. I mean, obviously it's coming to the supplemental round, but and he's gotten some helium. He was pretty high on both Baseball America's list and Sickles' list, who come from very opposite directions or very different viewpoints, certainly.
Yeah, you can sort of sense that his star is rising in the organization.
I think a little too much, but that's me.
That is you. It is not me.
No. I think he's fine. He's a very good prospect. I mean, he's not in my top 10, and I think that I'm going to be an outlier on that.
You will be in mine,
I think. Yeah, I know. That's fine. That's fine. That will be another epic podcast in the coming weeks, I'm sure.
Yeah, that won't be too much further down the line. I mean, it's prospect ranking season. You mentioned Sickles just came out with his. We already saw Baseball America's
a
month ago.
Fangraphs has theirs. I think we're just waiting on Parks, and he's doing the NL East last, so that'll probably be pretty close to when pitchers and catchers report.
Yeah, we're almost there.
And second to last, the penultimate bit of news for the week. Jason Bay retired, Rob.
Jason Bay was still playing baseball?
He was. I think I heard about every single home run he hit for Seattle last year from a Mets beat writer on Twitter, probably.
Yeah, that story got old, but then it got sad because suddenly you stopped hearing about them, and I realized that he pretty much did the same thing for Seattle that he had done for the Mets.
And then he got designated for assignment. And I bear Jason Bay no ill will.
Yeah, I don't think anybody does.
That's the thing about it. It's like, it's not, there have been, I mean, it's not his fault. I think we all kind of first guessed that contract to a certain extent, but it's still, it's not like, I feel like there have been bigger contracts in the context of their time, I guess, given out, or similar contracts that I projected my anger about them onto the player more. Jeremy Burnett's always comes to mind. But with Bay, he just always seemed like such a, like, you just couldn't, it was just sad. It made everyone uncomfortable.
Yeah, and especially him. That was the worst part, that he, like, was so sad and embarrassed and, like, really humbled by it that it just made you even more uncomfortable watching him be uncomfortable.
I mean, I guess as bad as you can feel for a guy that made $100 million playing baseball, you can feel bad for Jason Bay.
I know we touched on this before. We didn't agree. And I never really, like, did any backup to support my point. What was a worse contract in baseball history?
The worst single contract in baseball history.
Obviously, like, financially, it's not necessarily at the top of the list, but in terms of, like, the return, I think as far as the Mets go, it's the worst.
The Bay contract? Yeah, probably.
I don't think they've missed before, but, like, in the era of contracts being, you know, ultra inflated and, like, into the 8-9 figures, I don't think they've missed on anyone as badly as they missed on Bay.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. I'd have to. It's tough because we don't really have, like, dollar per war figures if you want to use those for, you know, going back 15, 20 years. You got all the, you know, the worst team money could buy contracts too. But, I mean, was Bay even, he was below replacement level for his time with the Mets, wasn't he?
Yeah, and that's exactly it. Like, even a guy like you would The one that always stands out to me, I mean, there are a couple, like Mike Hampton and Barry Zito. Like, they were really bad in relation to the numbers that they got, but, like, at least they brought back a positive return.
The Ryan Howard, we'll see how the Ryan Howard extension plays out.
Oh, yeah, very fair point. That could take the cake when all is said and done.
I mean, the A-Rod contract isn't looking great either, but we'll see how that goes. I mean, the Pujols one could be kind of nasty, too. I would say as of present day, those are all good choices. I think the next 10 years, we're probably going to see a new... I mean, the Vernon Wells deal, too. Though I guess he had a couple decent seasons in there, even.
Yeah, it's hard to find someone who really didn't bring any value whatsoever. Although, you know what? Actually, thinking back to that very same offseason, I think Sean Figgins was probably... He got...
I think the first year, I don't think he was terrible. I think it was at least above replacement value. I think maybe Darren Dreifert, wasn't he hurt for the entire duration of that deal? As was Jason Schmidt, I think.
Yeah. Okay, so I think we're definitely into that, like, rarefied air.
Pitchers are their own category, too, because they're inherently more risky. I mean, some would say the Johan Santana contract was kind of terrible, but...
True.
I mean, at the end of the day, when he was healthy, he was very effective.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I'm talking about with Bay. Like, there was never that, like, honeymoon phase or even, like, the slight respite where he would sort of, like, make you forget that he's a really bad player. He was just always bad.
Sure, even when we were first guessing that contract, I was like, well, you know, the first year or two, he should at least be okay, and it just didn't happen.
Yeah. Just a sad situation, and probably better for everyone that it is now passed.
And our last bit of news for the week, the Zips projection, Dan Samborski's projection system, you can find over at Fangraphs, came out this week for the Mets. I want to touch a little briefly on this because there were some interesting things in there. Nothing particularly egregious in one direction or the other, but I thought there were some interesting things in there. Primarily, he has Wilfredo Tovar as being a more valuable major leaguer than Ruben Tejada this year.
You know, I don't mind hearing that.
It's, you know, I was looking at the, he has some projecting, he has projected to post similar, triple slash numbers with Tovar getting the edge at shortstop. And I was looking at the projection. It was like 250 something, 300, 330, which really isn't out of the realm of possibility for Tovar.
No, I mean, he pretty much does that at every level. It's just a matter of whether you think he can do it against the best pitchers in the world, which is sort of a big bet, but it's not impossible.
And he only has him as a +5 defensive shortstop, which is reasonable. It just goes to show you how much value there is in a shortstop that can even hit a little bit and field a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, if you're bearish on Tovar's defense and, excuse me, I have it backwards. If you're bullish on Tovar's defense and bearish on Tejada's bat bouncing back, I feel like that's a defensible position.
And it looks like he'll, at least at this point in time, make the team out of spring training, I think, because they have no other, you know, his tourists who they were linked to early in the offseason and here and there since then signed with the Astros, and there's just not that many shortstops left on the market unless they want to bring back Quintanilla. And at this point, I think maybe you roll the dice with Tovar.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, you're looking for someone who can defend the position, and you know you have that already, so why go and spend the additional resources on somebody else? Or just play Flores there.
You know, that would be fun. If not. Yeah, that would be interesting.
It would be watchable.
It would be just
sort of way.
Imagine Daniel Murphy and Wilmer Flores trying to turn double plays for 162 games.
I don't want to.
I mean, not that it's an extreme ground ball staff or anything. You know, I almost wish they'd get a little more creative with stuff like that. Like, I don't know if it's worth it to keep, you know, Flores on the roster to only start him when, like, at shortstop when Dylan G and, you know, Bartolo Colon pitch. But maybe it is.
Yeah, that, I think that's one of the more interesting questions.
Then start him in left field when Mejia's pitching? I don't know. But it's like... we'll get into this when the actual... we get into the actual, like, previewing of the Mets season, but if they want to be competitive this year, like, they're going to have to get creative in the same way, I think, sort of the... I mean, the Pirates had a lot of things go right for them last year, too, especially in terms of their bullpen. But, you know, they really emphasized two-seam fastballs and extreme defensive shifts. I don't know if the Mets can necessarily do that, but, you know, starting Wilmer Flores at shortstop when there's a fly ball pitcher on the mound. I mean, he's not Howard Johnson, but he's close enough for government work.
It goes back to sort of the discussion from last week. Josh Satin or Lucas Duda in the leadoff position. Looks weird, but sort of that out-of-the-box idea that we're looking for.
And it's like they're better hitters than Eric Young is against their respective platoon sides.
Yeah, I mean, it's weird. It looks funny, and there are definitely downsides to it, but ultimately they're just better offensive options.
I mean, the obsession with leadoff hitter kind of drives me nuts anyway, because all your leadoff hitter is the guy you're going to give the most plate appearances to. That's it. Yeah.
I think that's sort of the most important point that people forget about the leadoff hitter. He's the guy that you are hand-selecting to face the opposition more than any other player that you have. So aside from the fact that he hits first and all of that, who do you want to represent you more than anyone else? You want one of your better players.
Yep. I mean, I forget what the exact number is in terms of plate appearance difference between each of the lineup spots. But let's say it's probably not that many, but
I was looking at it for the leadoff post the story that I put up a couple weeks ago, and it's like generally I think the leadoff spot will average over the course of a season 4.8 plate appearances a game. Jump down to the middle of the order and basically pull out a half of an at bat. So like you're closer to like, you know, 4.3, and then the further you go down, I think it ends with the pitcher getting like 3.9.
So I mean, let's say the Satin Duda platoon hits like fifth this year or sixth. You're talking about, you know, 80 plate appearances over the course of a season that you're giving to Eric Young Jr. instead of the Duda Satin platoon. Yeah. That's not we know lineup construction doesn't matter in an individual game, but over the course of a season, it can add up when you have that kind of an extreme.
Yeah, and I mean, if you're looking for slight edges, because that's what the Mets are going to have to do, I mean, they're not going to go out and sign an impact player at this point. They're going to have to, you know, look for those little, you know, margins to look for any incremental value that they can find, and that's, you know, 80 at bats is a pretty good place to find them.
Yeah, every little. I mean, they should just bat David Wright lead off, but that's never going to happen.
Yeah, that came up in the comments for that story, and I did. I mean, on the surface, you'd think that I would support that. Like I said, you
well, want to... if you bat right leadoff, you have to bat like Tejada ninth and the pitcher eighth.
Yeah, I mean, in principle, I won't just completely dismiss it, but it creates a lot of issues that.
I mean, it's true. I guess Wright should probably bat second.
Yeah, because ultimately, the idea that you can waste power, and he's not a power hitter per se, but on the Mets he is, and it's again on a team that doesn't hit a lot of home runs or even a lot of extra base hits as they're currently constructed, you definitely want to maximize the ones that you're going to get, and you know you're going to get a bunch from David Wright.
And my last little tidbit on Zips, the part that pissed me off, he is I shouldn't say he, that's not fair. The system has Henry Mejia's replacement level pitcher, so you can just throw it all out.
Yeah. Shame on me because I don't remember who put it up. Was it Brian Grosnick? put up an interesting story again in the last week on Amazing Avenue. I'm sure you can find it not too far down the timeline, referring to that same idea that Henry Mejia may be undervalued by that and many systems.
I think that was Steve Schreiber, actually.
Oh, right. That was a Steve Schreiber story. Apologies to Steve, because it was a good one. And it's a...
So you assumed it had to be like one of our... no, it had to be a Beyond the Box Score writer, clearly.
Yeah. No assumptions. That was just the first name that came to mind. But yeah, I mean, it's a valid point to make that he could very easily be undervalued coming to the season, because sort of those of us who have watched him really closely know what he can do, and that might be a hidden source of some value coming into the season.
Rob, we're 45 minutes in. We haven't gotten to the emails yet.
Let's get to the emails.
Let's start with the housekeeping. As always, you can email the podcast at podcast@AmazingAvenueAudio.com. And this is, in fact, Amazing Avenue Audio, the official podcast of your SB Nation New York Mets site, Amazing Avenue. Find us at AmazingAvenue.com, on Twitter at Amazing Avenue, on Facebook at Facebook.com/AmazingAvenueFans. You can find the podcast on iTunes. Just search for Amazing Avenue Audio, and you can listen or subscribe right there. I encourage you to do both. I also encourage you to rate and review the podcast on iTunes. You also find the podcast on the Stitcher app. Download it directly from AmazingAvenueAudio.com or listen to the embedded player that goes up in the podcast post at Amazing Avenue. I'm your host, Jeffrey Paternostro. You can find me on Twitter at Jeff Paternostro, and my co-host this week is Rob Castellano. You can find him on Twitter at _RobCast. And this is the email segment where we answer your emails. And our first email is from our punk rock correspondent, Sylvan. I offer a dilemma. The evil gremlin Wilpo, I assume that's like it's not a typo. He's actually calling the gremlin Wilpo, which I appreciate, forces you to enter one of two magical portals into a hellish reality. One, Ike Davis is the Mets' eternal opening day cleanup hitter, and he bats 150 in the first half of every Mets season for the rest of your life. Or two, every Mets pitching prospect has Tommy John surgery during his breakout season for the rest of your life. Which door do you choose?
Oh, wow. This is getting grim.
It is. It's getting... It's winter is coming. Actually, it's technically already winter, but whatever. Jeez.
Well, he did say the rest of your life. Does that mean the rest of Jeff's life?
What, are you trying to, like Take every actuarial table you can. You're trying to just like manipulate the actuarial tables now to get you a couple extra years. That was happening.
Said you were falling apart. Suddenly you're coming down with like some sort of monster flu. Maybe.
Hey, my grandmothers are 102 and 101 respectively. So.
Wow! Congratulations to them. Awesome. Okay, never mind. We're in for a long haul here.
Yeah. I guess it's easier to. Now, I'm going to be fair and assume that Davis hits 150 and gives you something close to his career average walk rate in ISO, which still makes him probably a slightly below replacement level player. Every I've Mets pitching happen. Prospect has Tommy John surgery during his breakout season. It's just starting pitching is so hard to replace, but it's only one season for each of them. Yeah, I guess I got to go in that direction.
Yeah. It's such a kick in the gut, though.
It is. It really is.
Like, at least with...
But, I mean, how many... Okay. So, in the next... All right. I don't smoke. I probably drink a little too much. I have a history of heart disease in my family, but that's... My cholesterol levels are low, and I'm trying to figure out actuarially. Let's say 50, next 50 years. I figure when I'm 81, I probably won't care about this bullshit anyway. So I got 50 years. How many good Mets pitching prospects can I expect to see? Because that's the thing. I get 50 seasons of Ike Davis, basically.
Oof, yeah, that's a tough pill to swallow.
And you're not going to have a breakout pitching prospect every season. I guess we should quantify pitching prospect here. Like, when Dylan G came up, was he would he count for the purposes of this exercise?
It would almost be more demoralizing if he did, because yeah. even like the B level, like back of the rotation guys go down.
That's, he wasn't even B level though. Like John Neese was more of that level. And I can accept John Neese counting for this.
Yeah.
But you have to make a, let's say you have to make a Baseball America top 100 list at some point in time. Does that seem like a fair qualifier?
I guess it depends on his wording. I didn't reread it.
Says every Mets pitching prospect.
I mean, that might just mean every.
But they have to have like a breakout season too, which I sort of associate with. I feel like we're devolving into semantics here as I'm 3/4 of the way through my hot toddy. I think I'm still taking the pitching prospect thing though.
I guess it turns into like a head versus heart sort of thing, because it's so demoralizing when that happens. Like with Harvey, it was just such a kick in the crotch. But with Davis, it's like more of a long, slow slog that you know that, like, I can't reach a reasonable conclusion on this. This is just too demoralizing to think about.
Yeah, so let's move on. Our next email is from Hank, and the subject line is SS, and it's not a shortstop question. You may be thinking, great, another shortstop question, but this is not that. This is about small sample sizes and when they are no longer considered meaningless. For example, in 2013, Daniel Murphy hit .354, .425 with .538 with two outs and runners in scoring position. But that's only 73 plate appearances. That may be too small of a sample size to call him a clutch player. If you factor in 2012 with 77 plate appearances, two outs and runners in scoring position at .343, .403, .486, and then in 2000, he literally lists like every season. All right, Daniel Murphy has been very good the last 3 years with two outs and runners in scoring position. And in his career, .342, .410, .483, and 293 plate appearances. That is more than conclusive enough evidence to call him clutch in my eyes. But is it really, or do you have to delve deeper into the numbers and look at his career runners in scoring position, .318, .373, .451, and 650 plate appearances? At what point do small sample sizes paint a picture and not just an idea of a player? What is the threshold? In 2013, when Eric Young Jr. led off an inning, he hit .306, .380, .392, and 209 at-bats. Does that mean anything at all, or is it just too small to mean anything? You look at his career numbers, .288, .362, .374, and 441 at-bats. Does that mean something? Does this warrant more playing time in the leadoff position, or just too small as well? What about Ike Davis when he came back from Vegas, .267, .429, .443, and 170 plate appearances, or his career second half numbers and 719 plate appearances? Do any of these numbers make you look at any of these players differently, or are they just too small to matter, like when Mike Jacobs first came up and looked like Babe Ruth for about a month? At what point do any of these numbers start to mean something? Hank, I'm going to point you directly to Russell Carlton's piece on Fangraphs about when sample sizes become meaningful.
A.K.A. Pizza Cutter.
A.K.A. Pizza Cutter. Also a former consultant for the Cleveland Indians. He's back at Baseball Prospectus, now running for them. And one of the best saber-heavy writers in the blogosphere, basically. But it depends on what you're looking at. I could actually just pull up his article because it's really easy to search for. You just search Fangraphs sample size.
Yeah, I have it in front of me. Type in when samples become reliable.
Yes. It depends on what you're looking at.
What I mean, looking for, and like the first one he lists here, swing percentage.
Right. So
after it's 50 plate appearances, that becomes somewhat reliable.
What we're really looking at is when we talk about is when it becomes a skill versus just random noise. Or a true talent level, I guess, is better than skill. So, you know, if you're like Josh Satin does not swing at pitches outside the strike zone, generally speaking. I think he had one of the lowest swing percentages in general, but especially at pitches outside of the strike zone. That's a kind of thing that you can identify as a talent very quickly, where something like your triple slash numbers take close to a full season worth of data before it becomes meaningful. And when we say meaningful, I think what he basically means is when it's more likely to be a true talent level than a just random noise. It's not to say there isn't some noise in the numbers, but it's over a, according to the data, over a 0.7 correlation higher for the split half reliability tests. I am not a statistician. But
you said it right. I mean, basically, you're looking for a correlation where you're seeing the least amount of variance between, you know, in this case, like a league average, and what we're seeing in a small sample.
Right, and I think you have to give these things context. Like, you can't just say Eric Young Jr. leading off an inning hits X, but how does that compare to league average? And I think more generally, when you're talking about clutch statistics, especially clutch. You know, clutch statistics over the course of several seasons, I don't want to say there's no such thing as a clutch hitter, because I don't think that's necessarily true. I think we can only really identify clutch hitters sort of post hoc. By the time the sample becomes meaningful, you're almost looking at like a full career's worth of clutch data. Because you give me two outs and runners in scoring position, that's great. But you can also look at runners in scoring position in general, close and late, high leverage. There's a lot of different quote-unquote clutch statistics, and some guys do well in some one season and not as well in others. I think the general rule is always default, and this is a sort of a MGL rule. He's one of the three authors of the book, along with Tom Tango and the other guy, whose name I never remember. Thank you.
That's his last name. It's not like some sort of weird.
Yes, I know.
His last name is Dolphin. I think it's Michael Dolphin, but I don't remember his first name.
Always default when you're regressing. Always default like when you're looking at like platoon splits right now. Always default to the largest sample, because that's where you just there's just not enough data even in a single season. Eno Saris wrote a great piece about this at Fangraphs a year or two ago, I think, sort of looking at whether like a season's worth of data is a meaningful sample, and it's kind of not. It's like a season is, it wasn't that whether meaningful data. Like a season is an arbitrary, like seasons are arbitrary endpoints. Is it, you don't get any better information looking at a player from April to October than you do from like July the previous year to July the next season. I think it's dangerous to read too much into. You'll basically go crazy. You go down the rabbit hole where you start looking at these numbers too much. Like, Daniel Murphy is a good hitter. I think we all sort of accept that. For some reason, the way it's like a, to use a well-worn, at this point, just kind of ridiculous poker analogy. This would have been well-worn in, like, 2008, but still. Like, once you get your money in the table, it doesn't matter how the cards come out. It's just that's like the order of which his performance happens doesn't say anything about the larger sample of the performance. Like Daniel Murphy is a slightly above average major league hitter when you adjust for park and league.
And yet people continue to drive themselves crazy by looking, parsing to those close and late or.
Right. He could hit 200, 230, 290 in two outs and runners in scoring position this year. And it would not surprise me at all in 75 plate appearances. It's just, you'll literally go crazy trying to parse samples. I guess from a, you know, from an organizational standpoint, just get the best players you can. You know, get the best hitters, and some years they'll hit better in runners in scoring position, some years they won't. That's not to say there isn't, could there be some things in their skill set or some things in their swing that make them better with runners in scoring position? Sure. One of the things about Justin Turner, though he didn't hit particularly well by the clutch metrics in the last year or so, you know, guys that put the ball into play more, because Turner has a well below average strikeout rate in like close and late and runners in scoring position situations, are going to have better things happen because they're more, It's like the other side of like random batting average on balls and play fluctuations. You're going to have a random season where you hit 360 on 75 plate appearances on batting average on balls in play with close and late or runners in scoring position. It's just going to happen.
Yeah, and then conversely, you'll have that season where you ground into 12 double plays in such situations.
Yeah. I mean, the Cardinals, as a team, had a ridiculous triple slash line with runners in scoring position this year. And it'll probably go back to relatively normal next year.
Yeah. For reference, Russell's piece determines that you get reliability as far as on-base percentage and slugging. Again, you mentioned the triple slash numbers, and I'm leaving batting average out of it because he never reached that point, at least within a season worth.
It's a lot. It's like a couple seasons worth, I think, before you really...
Well, for on-base and slugging, it's 500 before you start to see a 0.7% confidence.
Right. And you have to be careful, too, because you're talking about individual samples in each... over a course of several years where, players change. They age. They change things mechanically.
And I think, going back to the question, Murphy's quote-unquote clutch stats, two outs and runners in scoring position, he's still... In his career, he's still only had 293 of those plate appearances. Late and close, he's still at 413. So he's still short of that 500 threshold where we start to see statistical, meaningful correlations here.
And it's a small enough sample where he hits, 200 in his next 80 plate appearances in those situations. It brings the numbers more in line with his career numbers, which is what you would expect.
Yeah, exactly.
Our next email is from Jeff. Hi, guys. Long time, first time. Since there are no player personnel moves to talk about, I thought I'd ask about steroids and statistics. Oh, great. I was going to try to avoid this, but here we go. In the wake of the dumb Hall of Fame voting, this is what happens when I don't really scan the emails as well as I should. The statistics say that home run per contact rates are down slightly since the peak of the so-called steroids era, but not by much. The dominant reason that scoring and home runs are down is because strikeouts are up significantly. Basically, pitching has gotten better relative to hitting over the last 15 years. So my question is, do you think there's a reason that pitching has gotten better due to better management of arms? The best pitchers are now kept on strict inning and pitch counts. They're less likely to blow out their arms, and they are pulled from the games before things can get out of hand. A higher fraction of the best pitchers in baseball are active at any one time. Batters are more likely to be facing a fresh reliever rather than a tired starter. So putting aside the other things in baseball, stadium sizes, juice balls, etc., do you believe that management of pitchers is a significant factor in declining hitter stats? Yes. I mean, you pretty much hit, Jeff, you nailed it. You hit on all sort of the points here. Joe Sheehan actually has done a lot of research into this, and he found, specifically on strikeout rates, that you can explain most of the declining offensive levels in strikeout rates in terms of like ISO on contact hasn't really changed. There was like a 3-year peak that's a slight outlier, if I think it was 99 to 2001 or 2000, 2002, but nobody really thinks that people were just taking steroids for those 3 years. Every time I get into a discussion of what I think steroids actually do in terms of baseball performance, I get yelled at. So we're going to stay out of that specifically and talk about pitcher management. And yeah, I think here's the thing. 15 years ago, it's not like, the one inning reliever as such is, as a conceit, is probably close to 25 years old now, sort of those La Russa A's teams. But this is, again, another point that Joe Sheehan brings up fairly often, is that you don't really have the guys that just come in the seventh inning and just throw 15 pitches, 8 of which are just wipeout sliders. They throw as hard as they can. Sort of like the Luke Gregersons of the world. Every team has like 2 or 3 of those guys. And they're always going to be better than a guy that's thrown 100 pitches. I don't care. And like outside of the top 5, top 5% of major league starters, your number ones and top tier number twos. And even some of those guys after 100 pitches, aren't going to be as effective as Mike Adams is going to be. And it seems like every team has a few of these guys. The Mets this year, have guys that just, Vic Black, Jairus Familia. I'm not even talking about Parnell. We'll stay out of closers, because the one in closer has been a thing for a while. You see a lot more left-on-left guys. than you probably did 25 years ago. So your best left-handed hitters late in games are not seeing, you are seeing tough lefty relievers.
Yeah, I concur. Specialization has drastically changed the game, probably more than most people realize. And we can get into lots of different reasons if we want to just focus on strikeout percentages going up. I mean, I think the mentality of hitters has sort of changed over the years. You know, if you look at follow the money, and you can see that typically power hitters get paid. But, you know, to sell out for power, you sort of have to accept the strikeout as well. I think that sort of plays into it, but, you know, that's more of a secondary storyline. The key storyline here is definitely the idea of specialization that the question sort of hit on.
Yeah, I mean, if you – it's kind of like why it's – and it's almost bad management at this point. Like, why would you let – and let's not even say use Ryan Howard as an example here because he has a rather extreme – platoon split, but you know, why are you gonna let David, you know, David Ortiz, there's pitchers in the AL East that exist solely to pitch David Ortiz. I think specialization has a lot to do with it. Pitcher, I mean, fastball velocities have certainly gone up over the last 25 years, I think, in general. The overall, maybe it's a thing where the overall talent level, there's more of an emphasis on pitching, drafting and development of pitchers. I know Kevin Goldstein and Jason Parks, back when they had the Up and In podcast, used to talk about the scouts they talk to think hitters don't get taught a good two-strike approach anymore. So it could be like an approach issue as well. I think there's a variety of factors. I think steroids just don't, it's not borne out in the numbers. I'm not saying for individual players steroids doesn't help, but I just don't think league-wide, it's really borne out in the numbers. You look at the change in offensive levels. That's due to the strikeout rate, unless you think steroids magically made guys hit the ball better, but strikeout rates have gone up basically for the entire history of baseball.
Yeah, there, like you said, many storylines in play. One of them is not steroids. At least not as far as strikeout percentage is concerned.
Our next email is from Carrie. Hi, Jeff / Rob. I was wondering what, to what extent you two agree with the recent top 10 organizational prospect list posted on Fangraphs.com. And he gives me, he gives me the link. I know recent consensus has Syndergaard and Darno at 1 and 2 respectively, but I was surprised that Mark Hewlett ranked Dominic Smith 2 spots ahead of Montero. I know you two are down on Rosario. Oh, you two. Yeah, also ranked above Montero. It's me.
Don't lump me in with Chad.
Also ranked above Montero, but could you make a case for Dominic Smith claiming that number 3 spot? Do you think scouts overvalue new prospects simply because they're new? If so, could that be a factor here? Short version, does Dominic Smith have skills? P.S. I can't decide whether your intro is too metal or not enough metal. Please discuss. Best, Carry in New Orleans. All right, we'll take this in reverse order. I think it's just the right amount of metal, actually.
I mean, if we want to go back to the origins, this was an Eric Simon pick.
It was, yes. It was just sort of, when I got the keys to the car, Eric sent me the 48-second MP3 file, and that was its...
I can just hear him now. There's one stipulation.
Greek melodic death metal. It seems so wildly inappropriate for what comes afterwards that I have grown to love it.
Yeah, I mean, I was all about like trying to get the rights to Electric Avenue.
Of course you were.
I mean, it just flows so nicely.
I should give Ira Kaplan a call and see if I can get the, I always, like the Yola Tango version of Meet the Mets is what I would have gone with.
Who is it? Is it the Strokes that are Mets fans?
They might be as well. Yola Tango is. I actually really kind of want the Ballad of. I could probably get, you know, make a phone call to the Isotopes and get the Ballad of Ray Ordonez as our theme too. But the die has been cast. It'll be melodic Greek metal as long as this podcast exists.
Yeah, we have very little say in that.
There just aren't a great. I don't think there's any other good Mets songs. There aren't really. Piazza New York Catcher by Bell and Sebastian.
A little too, like...
It's very twee, which isn't necessarily inappropriate, but...
Not upbeat enough.
No, fair enough. I guess I will defer to our punk rock correspondent, Sylvan. Sylvan, do you have an idea for a better opening theme for the podcast? Send it along. We'll talk about it on the podcast. I'm always willing to talk a little bit of music.
How about the Fangraphs top 10?
So let's talk about Dominic Smith. Yeah, I mean, I could totally see an argument for ranking him number 3. If your projection for Dominic Smith is above average regular, I mean, I have, you know, Montero, Flores, and Puelo, who's sort of my 3-4-5 tier of guys, as all sort of like solid everyday but not special guys. If you think Smith's an above average first baseman, yeah, sure, you can put him at 3. I have no problem with that.
I mean, basically, you need to buy into the idea that he's an impact level hitter, the sort that the Mets haven't really had in a long time. I mean, when we discuss guys in that tier, just the names that you've named, each of them come with baggage. I mean, we know that Pueyo has serious plate discipline issues. Flores can't play the field to any extent. And then who was the last name he said? Montero.
Right.
I mean, I'm sort of with you. I think he's a little bit undervalued, but you know, he's a undersized righty, which is never, you know, a great recipe for success at the major league level.
I mean, for context, he has Smith as a 6, which would be an above average major league regular. Montero is a 55, which is roughly where I have him. That's like a 3-4 starter, basically. You know, Flores he had low.
Yeah,
yes. Flores is a
10 on the list. He's down.
He has him as a 5, and he didn't rank Pueyo.
So very down on Pueyo, and yeah, down on Flores. A lot of people are down on Pueyo.
Yeah, that just seemed to be a weird theme of the offseason. But yeah, I think you can if you think Smith is an above average everyday first baseman in the end, you could absolutely rank him as number 3. My issue with Smith, and I. You know, we had Hudson Belinsky on the podcast back in August-ish, and he was very high on Smith. You know, he saw him down in the Gulf Coast League and liked what he saw. It's a weird profile, because I was...
What do you mean, physically?
Yeah, I was dicking around with the play index of Baseball Reference. There's no major league first baseman that's had a meaningful career since basically Wally Joyner that was under 6'1".
It's a very fair criticism. I mean, it's a position where you need to hit for power, and generally little guys don't hit for power. And not to say that he's little. I mean, he's stout. He's sort of built like a fire hydrant almost. But you're right. It's definitely, if you want to look for red flags, that would be one.
Actually, I misspoke slightly. Because, I mean, obviously Prince Fielder is under 6'1". There's no one that I think I set the parameters. It's at under 6'1" and under 200 pounds. There was no. Basically, you have to go back to like Steve Garvey and Keith Hernandez, like those types of players. You have to go back to the '80s to find them. You can find like short, fat dudes that can hit a lot, like Prince Fielder. But there's just nobody that looks like Dominic Smith. And you know, demography isn't destiny, certainly, but. It's if he makes the major leagues as a first baseman and is an above average regular, he will be a unique profile.
Definitely. On the other side of the coin, I think you just sort of look at what he's done and look at what he can do. The tools, at least the sort of rudiments of them, are there. The scouts rave about the swing from the left side. It's not that he doesn't hit for power, that he hasn't. You know, he put out a 439 slug in his pro debut, and the plate discipline is there, something that rarely do you see that at such a low level. I mean, there's a lot going on to like, and so there are reasons to sort of project him out as that above average first baseman. You can see it, but it's sort of depends on what you're looking for. You can make the case for it. You can easily make the case that you know, like you said, he's sort of an odd duck. Doesn't really look like that prototypical first baseman. And it's a really long ways away before we're going to see that first baseman at the major league level. So a lot can go wrong before then.
And just generally speaking, it's very difficult to be a first base prospect. I think we've discussed this before. A lot of your major league first baseman, even your good major league first baseman, were not first baseman in the minors. Albert Pujols was a third baseman, as was Mark Teixeira. I guess Freddie Freeman. I think Freddie Freeman played a couple different places, actually. But you see a lot of third basemen, right fielders, you know, guys that just sort of have to move. The occasional catcher.
Basically it speaks to the idea that you need to crush. You need to be a masher.
You have to hit a ton to be a first base prospect.
Yeah, just hard to find guys who will hit like that at the highest levels. I mean, it's just hard to find them. And you can sort of assume that the Mets have found one, but you know, the odds will tell you that they haven't just based on probability, so it's easy to sort of go with that side of the argument as well.
But that said, I mean, it's not like after D'Arnaud and Syndergaard, there's not like a clear impact talent. So you could rate, I don't know, I guess you could rate 3 through, you know, I think you could make an argument for 6 different guys as the third best prospect in the Mets system, and I wouldn't laugh you out of the building.
Yeah, I mean, like, I think you can basically say 3 through 10. It's a really fungible list at this point.
Yeah, I mean, you could rate, obviously, Puelo, Montero, and Flores. Dominic Smith, certainly. Yeah, if somebody told me Steven Matz was the third best prospect in the system, I'd listen to them. And I'd probably even listen to Nimmo, to be honest with you. I know you probably wouldn't, but
I wouldn't laugh anyone out of the building. I mean, yeah. You can make the case. Yeah. You can absolutely make the case. I wouldn't make the case. But you can. I mean, you could put Flores up there.
Yep. After the top two guys, there's not really – everybody has their warts, basically.
How did you feel about I think we already sort of know how you feel. He had Plawecki number 6.
That's too high. It's just, you know, and I like Kevin Plawecki. I do. He was barreling everything I saw, but it's just – he's supposed to do that. Is exactly what he's supposed to do. He did what he was supposed to do this year. He was a Big Ten. He was a Division I college catcher that went out and mashed a ball. And I think, you know, he's a major leaguer, certainly. Just that arm scares the piss out of me.
Yeah, I think that's, you're sort of hitting on it. If he's a true catcher, he did do what he's supposed to do, but, I mean, it's hard to find guys who put up, you know, like an 800 OPS at that level as a true catcher. If you go back and sort of parse out the numbers, you don't see it a lot. So if you believe he's a true catcher, you can get excited about it, and I sort of have. I'm more on the boat that I do think you believe he belongs in the top 10, but you need to buy into the fact that he's a catcher and he's a starting catcher defensively first. And the arm is definitely a big red flag.
Yeah, and I mean, if he goes out this year in AA and hits 300, I'll be like, okay.
That's like a top 3 prospect.
Yeah, so. I mean, he could definitely jump up a Mets prospect list this year. Absolutely, but from what I've seen so far, and again, I like him as a prospect, certainly. I just don't, you know, there's just guys I'd rather have just based on the, like, Dylson Herrera. I think Dylson Herrera is a better prospect.
Oh, man. I think we butt heads there. I like Dylson Herrera, but the difference in plate discipline for me is what settles it. Because they both can play a premium. I mean, I like a catcher more, but they're both, you know, middle of the field players. So defensively, you like them both.
I mean, Plawecki makes a lot of contact, but he's, you know, he's a grip and rip it guy. He's not the traditional, like, high walk dude. He'll go up there and try to hit the ball, try to drive the ball the opposite way. I mean, he's, as he moves up the ladder, I'm curious to see where the walks go. But again, yeah, if he hits 300 with a 390 on base percentage in double A, sign me up. Because, I mean, the arm's a limiting factor in his, I think he can catch, certainly, but the arm's going to be a limiting factor in how good of a catcher he actually is.
Agreed. I think for me, I think Plawecki is surprisingly close to the finished product that, you know, if he becomes an impact major leaguer, I don't think he's remarkably far from that product right now. Whereas a guy like Herrera has so much to do to become that player. And, you know, you could say that about anybody. I mean, you could say that about, you know, Flores, or hell, I mean, a guy like Zach Lutz. But the fact of that...
Wow, it took you a full 80 minutes to get Zach Lutz into the...
Good thing that I forgot him. In our minds and in our hearts, always. But Plawecki is, again, to harp on the obvious here, he's a catcher. And so for a guy who could potentially be a starting catcher at the major league level, to not be that far from his... not necessarily his ceiling, but his, you know, valuable version of himself at the major league level, to me, that means a lot. And we've gone over this before. That's sort of what I look for in a prospect. It's not necessarily the best thing you can find in a prospect, but it's something that I sort of value, in so much as prospects fail so damn often that once you have some confidence that they won't, I think you sort of have to value that.
And I will take the second baseman, the good defensive second baseman who could hit 15 to 20 home runs.
Yeah, you know what I'd love to see? It's not going to happen, but I'd love to see Herrera try shortstop.
Oh, I think it might happen.
You think so?
Where was I talking about this with? I think I was talking with, like, Toby and G-Chat or something. They have nobody... look, Phil Evans is not a shortstop. They have nobody to play shortstop in St. Lucie this year unless, say, promote Evans. Or hold Reynolds back, and I'm not entirely sure they'll do either. And they have not been shy about, you know, they moved Matt Reynolds to shortstop. They kept Flores on shortstop a while. They haven't been shy about keeping people on premium positions. I would not be shocked if they try Herrera at shortstop. I don't think he has the arm for it, but...
yeah, ultimately that's the problem, that his arm is just so damn weak that, I mean, they can try it, and I hope that he can, you know, build arm strength or something, but as he's currently constructed, he is not... he's not a major league shortstop. He cannot get it across the diamond fast enough.
But I find there's not a lot of major league shortstops in the Florida State League. So,
true. Give it a try. I would love to see it.
Our last email is from Michael. Hello, gentlemen. Rob, like you, I am proudly a baseball purist for all their sports along with their narratives bore me. So you might want to skip the first 5 minutes of the podcast, Michael, which is information that does you no good right now. So needless to say, around this time of year, I'm really scrambling to find baseball news, minus A-Rod being A-Rod, let alone Mets news to fill the void. Despite the additions the Mets have made this offseason, as well as their impressive crop of young pitchers, there's still such a negative connotation whenever the Mets are discussed via the mainstream media. Even stat geeks and prospect gurus seem to commonly mistake the Mets brand for a pile of steaming poo. You can use profanity on this podcast. It's okay, Michael. Having said that, Sickles was very complimentary in his recent Mets system review. Should all of this bother me? After all, dopey writers, former players, and other talentless hacks tend to unimaginatively base their annual projections is in quotes, on whomever has the most recent success. Case in point, the Red Sox, after finishing with 69 wins in 2012, they were a dysfunctional organization, yet this offseason they've only subbed A.J. Pierzynski, don't judge my spelling, I think, yeah, it's not spelled correctly, and catcher, and suddenly they're locked to repeat as World Series champions. In your opinion, will the media ever stake the reputation of the Mets again, or have they taken a fool us thrice shame on us stance after picking the Mets to win the pennant from 2007 to 2009? Fan as always, Michael. I just don't care about preseason projections. I mean, we're going to do them, and I'm going to project the Mets to win probably 75 games. But, I mean, you're right. There's always, even given better data sets than, you know, John Kruk and some production intern on Baseball Tonight discussing the upcoming segment on predicting the NL East. There's always going to be outliers. There's going to be teams that, you know, overperform the available data and underperform the available data. A lot of it's injuries, and you can't always project injuries. You know, for the Red Sox, they literally won the World Series by, to a certain extent, I mean, the bounce back from their core players helped as well, by having every mid-tier free agent signing break right for them. The Giants, the first World Series the Giants won, same thing. Basically every 34-year-old that Brian Sabian signed had a career year, or had a great, you know, late career season. Any team that wins the World Series, or even makes the playoffs, because the playoffs are a crapshoot, any team that makes the playoffs is going to, you know, by definition, have a certain amount of things break right for them. I think that's been especially true since sort of the Yankees dynasty era, let's say. You know, the Diamondbacks had, you know, Rhode Johnson and Schilling and a great Luis Gonzalez season. And Johnson and Schilling stayed healthy the entire year. You actually look, I had a conversation about this the other day, I think in my bowling pro shop, about who the other starters, like, were on that Diamondbacks team. I think Miguel Bautista made a playoff start for them that year. Like, the rest of you, I don't know if you could name another, I mean, Byung-Young Kim, but he was a reliever. I don't know if you could name another starter. Like, there were some weird pitchers that made starters for those Diamondbacks teams. You know, the Marlins, obviously, in 2003, caught some breaks and had their young pitchers, you know, Burnett and Josh Beckett step up for them. You know, the Angels certainly caught their fair share of breaks in 2002. And even more, the Chicago White Sox got something like 7 complete games in the playoffs when they won the World Series. And even during the actual season, they basically got career years from every single one of their starters. That's the kind of things that happen, you know, to at least some of the playoff teams every year. Like the Pirates this year certainly had a lot of things break right for them. You know, whether it's staying healthy or getting a few career years from, you know, your league average otherwise players. That's the kind of stuff that has to happen for a team to make the playoffs a lot of the times, and it's difficult to predict.
I think this is an interesting discussion. I think this is a potential, like, jumping off point for a much larger discussion. Assuming that nothing big happens before next week, I wouldn't mind re-hitting this topic and sort of going over, you know, a handful of what needs to go right for the Mets to defy the odds and make the playoffs, because I think we could get into a really interesting discussion about that.
I mean, I've thought about it, certainly. I mean, even a team that's, let's say their true talent level is between, you know, even with Harvey out, let's say it's between 75 and 78 wins, which I think the Zips projections had them right around 75. I think they had like 27 WAR, and I think replacement level is like 48 wins. I may be making a complete hash of that, but I looked at it. At one of the projection systems had them around 75 wins. It might not have been Zips. I may have been looking at like Steamer or something. But so even if they're a 75 win true talent level team, they could easily. That basically, to me, that means they're going to finish somewhere between 65 and 85 wins. Most of the time. Yeah, that's probably your two standard deviations right there, either way. And that's a very wide wide berth. If their starting pitching stays healthy, they do what the Reds did 2 years ago, and, you know, like 160 of the 162 starts are made by Zach Wheeler, John Neese, Dylan G, Bartolo Colon, and Henry Mejia. You know, that will certainly help. And we know that's to be unlikely because Montero and Syndergaard are going to get a look at some point. But you can throw those two into the mix too. So I think they're of comparable talent level to some, you know, someone like Dylan G. Could Noah Syndergaard come in and give you roughly what Dylan G is going to give you? Sure. You know, they're not using Chris Schwindon and Aaron Harang or the Aaron Harang of 2014 for, you know, 30 starts. You know, Daisuke Matsuzaka isn't making August appearances. You know, so basically the starting pitching stays healthy. And Travis d'Arnaud takes a step forward. He's an, you know, above average everyday catcher. And David Wright is healthy for 150 games. And Curtis Granderson and Chris Young bounce back. And Juan Lagares is closer to a league average hitter. And the first base platoon is above average. All of a sudden now, is that an 85 win team? Kind of sounds like it to me.
I mean, that's, I think that's even, that's asking even a bit much, even for an 85 win team. I think suddenly you're even pushing 85 wins. I think that's even more, because
that's and that's literally every single thing going right, basically. Yeah. It's every, I haven't even talked about the bullpen being good. But by the same token, you know, John Neese, you know, misses six starts because he usually misses six starts. Travis d'Arnaud has some injury issues and some strikeout issues, and it's a little bit below average, but not terrible. The first place first base platoon is below average, but not terrible. Chris Young is you know, is a one-win player because the strikeouts just eat into too much of his value, and he's playing in a corner mostly, and Juan Lagares still can't hit, and isn't, you know, is a plus 10 center fielder instead of a plus 25 center fielder, and David Wright misses 30 games instead of 10 games, and all of a sudden, you know, Zach Wheeler doesn't take a step forward. I mean, people are counting on Zach Wheeler to be sort of the anchor of that rotation. This is a guy that walked, you know, did not strike out two batters for every batter he walked last year. And I'm not even, you know, delving into pitcher injuries, which could throw this whole thing down the toilet real quickly, because they just don't have a lot of starting pitching depth. And all of a sudden you're looking at a 65 win team and a top five draft pick. So there's always going to be a range of outcomes. You know, more likely, some of the good things will happen and some of the bad things will happen, and they'll be in the 75 win range. But I mean, anything more than that is just, you know, errant speculation.
Yeah, I don't know that we're going to see any media outlets go out on a limb for the Mets. I mean,
and to be perfectly honest, they shouldn't. There's no reason to believe that this is a playoff contender as currently comprised in 2014.
Yeah. I mean, generally, specifically speaking about the media, generally they're a year late. Generally, they get on board. I mean, like we mentioned in the question, nobody was on board with the Red Sox until suddenly it seemed that the Red Sox were back to being the beast of the East, the contending Red Sox. The storyline in the spring was they're a mess of a franchise and they need to get themselves out of this black hole that they fell into. The Mets really aren't going to garner a lot of support in the media until they prove that they're not a third or fourth place team in the NL East anymore.
I mean, they're at 70, when they win 74 games last year, 75.
Yeah, I think 74, I think.
74, two straight years?
74, yeah, for the second season in a row.
They have a $90 million payroll. They have one, you look at their opening day lineup, they have one guy where you look at, like, that's an above average major league regular. Definitely pencil it in. That's David Wright. Their pitching staff, well, it could be good, certainly has some question marks. I mean, is there generally a, like, we can talk about the sort of the LOL Mets media bias, but I think that's a separate issue from this specific one, which they just haven't, you know, Washington went out and got Doug Fister for nothing. You know, the Braves have a very, very good young rotation. The Phillies, I don't freaking know what the Phillies are doing, but it's not an easy, yes, the Mets are an easy target in a lot of ways. I mean, they always have been, and this goes, you know, whether they're good or whether they're bad. But, I don't know, I can't. I think you're right. It'll be a year late. They'll pick the Mets to win the pennant the year after they win the pennant.
Yeah, I mean, if we want to make this into an immediate discussion, that's when that will happen. And don't expect many media outlets to go out on a limb for the Mets or anybody. And in terms of the coverage of the team, I mean, the media is sort of like a reflection of the fan base. The fan base looks at them as, you know, lovable losers And so that's how they're going to be portrayed in the media. That ends when the Mets start winning. And, you know, fans look at the team as a winning franchise. They'll be covered as a winning franchise. They'll be chosen in projection systems as a team that's going to be a contender. But coming off of two straight 74-win seasons, it's not going to happen. And we can discuss the actual, you know, nuts and bolts and the X's and O's and where we think they're going to end up. But as far as how the media is going to look at them, that's pretty much how it's going to happen. I mean, that's cut and dry, very easy. We see it year in, year out. That's pretty much how the Mets and any other, you know, lower third team is treated.
And I mean, it's not like they really haven't vastly reshaped their roster.
Yeah.
Like, even to the extent the Red Sox did after 2012.
Yeah. I mean, there are reasons to be excited, so I don't want to completely
I think it'll be a fun team to watch, because that's probably might be a bit of an overreach on my part, but it'll be better, maybe. I got nothing. I mean, like July, when you can see, you know, Wheeler, Syndergaard, Montero 3 out of every 5 days, maybe.
Yeah, and that goes back to your discussion of what would need to go right. And that, I mean, if those three can really take hold, that would go a long way. And I think that sort of has to be one of your keynote statements when you discuss, can the Mets contend in 2014? And I think they can. I don't know if I'd put, you know, I wouldn't bet the farm on it or anything, but it's not going to be portrayed that way in the media, at least.
Let me see. This isn't a great framework for it, but let's take a look at the current futures bets for the Mets winning the World Series. This is as of the beginning of the month. And I'm doing this on Bleacher Report, which makes me I'm not going through a slideshow. Are you kidding me?
And you're surprised about this?
I shouldn't be, but just like... God damn it. Are you serious?
30 greatest MLB bets in history.
I just, you know, fucking Bleacher Report. God damn it. I apologize to any listeners that write for Bleacher Report, but not really. It's all Bleacher, like, literally all of these links are Bleacher Report. It's just, I don't even know why I bother Googling things about sports anymore.
I think that sort of speaks to the question and about media. Consume what you want. You don't have to consume everything.
All right. I found.
What you want to consume.
There are so many ads on this page. It's not Bleacher Report, but it's, oh my lord. My 6-year-old MacBook is not happy about. Where? Okay, now it's a pop-up. Hang on. I'm going to get this. Scroll. What is... Oh my god, it's like a... I don't even know what this is. It's like a Carnival Cruise. Where's the X out? There it is. It's like Examiner. I don't even know what this is. It's examiner.com.
Wow, you're leading us down a dark rabbit hole here.
All right, the Mets are plus 8,000. The same odds as the Minnesota Twins. The only teams with worse odds to win the 2014 World Series are the Marlins and the Astros. It's all for entertainment purposes only.
What is that? What's the format? Like, I'm generally, I don't gamble, but like I would expect to hear like one in like
plus 8,000 means you bet $100 to win $8,000. So it's like 80-1.
Okay. You know what? I'd make that bet. I wouldn't expect to get my money back, but...
That's not... awful.
I mean, considering that they're on level with the Astros and the Twins...
I mean, that division's not that good compared to the AL West, certainly, at least. I mean, they're... In order to view... What the... Oh, good lord. Whatever. Anyway, I don't know where I was. But yeah, I mean, no one's betting on the Mets to win the 2014 World Series.
Basically, that should be the disclaimer at this point. Don't take this as an encouraging statement to go ahead and put your money out on the Mets. They're probably not going to make the playoffs, let alone win the World Series. But fun to think about.
And it could happen. Stranger things have happened, which I think what you have to keep in mind anytime you're looking at preseason predictions. So that's the emails for the week. As always, you can email the podcast at podcast@amazonavenueaudio.com. And I think that about wraps things up. I don't really have anything else. Do you got anything else? I guess the Amazon Avenue Regional Gathering here is coming up in the coming weeks. I don't think we've settled on a date or a bar in the city yet, but I'm going to try to get down for it. I don't have my flop house in Bay Ridge anymore, so it's more difficult for me to get into the city on the weekends, but it's in Manhattan, so I'll just take the train in and get sauced and take the train back out, which will be entertaining for the rest of you, probably.
Yeah. I've been away for a few days. I don't know the details, but I'm assuming do we have some deets?
There are no deets. I think we're still, there's a post up on another site. Steve Sippa is organizing it again. We did it last year at the Ginger Man, which is, I forget exactly where it is, but it's either like in Flatiron or Midtown or that general vicinity. It's not hard to get to. I was okay with the Ginger Man. It was kind of, 7 p.m. on a Saturday, everything's going to be kind of crowded, but it was a little more crowded than I tend to like. I know there were a couple other suggestions in the comments, we'll see. But it'll be somewhere in Manhattan where there's beer, which is all I really require to show up, so.
I mean, we can do the Ginger Man in Greenwich and make it a lot easier on me, but.
Yeah. Maybe it'll be in the next, end of January, early February. It's a good time. We had a pretty good turnout last year. Some commenters, some writers. So I encourage any of you that can get out for it to get out for it. And I'm still trying to figure out like the logistics of doing an actual like Connecticut meetup with maybe a live podcast recording. We'll see how that goes. Been showing some slack lately.
And that's not even to speak of a potential trip to Montreal.
Oh, I'm definitely doing that. I got the tickets.
Oh, have you ordered yours? I'm still like somewhat.
I got them like the day. I got them like in a pre-sale. I had to navigate a French language website to do it.
Yeah, I had a hard time navigating the site, but for scheduling reasons, once again, I'm sort of on the fence, but I'm really hoping to make the trip.
Actually, I remember texting my wife like, so they announced what are you doing the weekend? It's like the March 28th. What are you doing the weekend of March 28th? She's like, I don't know. I have like a couple. I might be going to a couple different conferences. Why? I'm like, well, the Mets are playing an exhibition game in Montreal, a couple exhibition games. We should go up for it. And she's like, well, yeah, man, sure. We'll see how. I already bought the tickets.
That wasn't a question.
It wasn't a question, no. So I will be there. Because I love Montreal.
I told you I've never been, so I really look forward to the opportunity. Hopefully,
I need to go back to Le Filet.
It's a
restaurant. It's very, very
restaurant,
good.
I'm guessing.
It's not like ridiculously fancy, but it was very, very good. One of the better meals of my life. Actually, I had a really great really great meal at Tokay too, but I won't be doing that again.
Ooh, I can only imagine.
It was, yeah, I spent a lot of money. It was my honeymoon. It's justifiable. So yeah, anything coming up in the coming week? Exciting news?
Let's see here. Well, as we sort of hit on, it's almost prospect. Well, it really is prospect ranking season, and it is almost prospect ranking season on Amazon Avenue. So we can sort of look forward to. We can look forward to that. The percolations are imminent, and I'm sure we'll have a lot of fallout here on the podcast.
That'll be a lot. It's like that was the first podcast we did was off your prospect list, actually.
Was it? Yeah, that's right. What a year it's been.
It has been almost a full year now of podcasts. I have nothing. I don't know. I have a new non-baseball related writing gig coming up, but until I actually started, I don't want to announce anything because of my own. I'm well aware of my own notorious unreliability. But I've got a couple things in the pipe there, which will probably come out on Twitter. And I'll pimp on the podcast as appropriate. I don't think I have anything else, really.
Sheffield Wednesday game recaps, y'all.
Oh, good Lord, no. You don't want me doing that. I will say I was kind of, I guess their regular color commentator. I think he has a, like, I remember he was going in for surgery for, like, his back or his knee or something. Last time I listened to one of the home broadcasts, they've been on TV a bit lately. But, they actually had one of the actual current players doing color commentary. He's injured right now. He's doing the color commentary today. It was, like, the best, like, commentary of a game I've ever heard. Like, funny, honest, insightful, just, like, amazingly good. Like, I was shocked at how good he was. Like, a complete natural. Like, dissecting what players should have done, giving, like, inside stories on some of the players, too. It's just, without, like, you know, stepping on any toes, but just, he struck a really great balance. It was just really, like, great, insightful soccer commentary. I was shocked. Like, I just imagine if you put, like, a player from any other sport, like, even, like, soccer players are notorious. Like any other sport, they're notorious sort of, like, having that sort of, like, media training, like the, you know, the bus scene in Bull Durham, like, drilled into their head. Or whatever the soccer equivalent of that is. But he was just very, like, sort of, like, off the cuff, just very, like, very smart. You know, would say when a player on his team should have done something else, and just gave a lot of insight into sort of the strategy and the preparation for a game and tactics and stuff like that. You just don't get that, like, in any sport. Like, it wasn't dumbed down at all.
Did the Mets do something like that with Brian Bannister when he was hurt?
He did do some post-game stuff for them, I think. And I've been saying for years they should get him back, either, like, into the booth or into doing post-game, as much as we all like streaming Bobby O.
Hell, I mean, as long as we're on the idea of injured players, get Harvey out there.
Yeah, that could be interesting. I mean, you never know who's sort of particularly well-spoken about their craft. Like, I always like reading David Lorilla and Eno Saris's, obviously, over at Fangraphs, when they do, like, either whether it's Lorilla's interviews or, you know, Eno sort of combining, you know, interview stuff with sabermetric stuff. His piece last year where he talked hitting with Joey Votto and pitch grips, I think it was with Dan Straley, were both excellent. But that kind of stuff, you can sort of get insight into who is comfortable speaking about it. Because it's a skill like anything else, being able to sort of speak intelligently about how you do what you do is not always something. Like, some guys just, you know, see ball, hit ball. So I do wonder who would be. I wonder if Harvey would be good at that. But he seems to have, you know, a pretty good feel for his game, beyond even just his sort of, like, impressive raw physical tools.
And at the very least, he can handle himself in front of a microphone, Qualcomm side.
Yeah, well, he's actually gotten a lot. I remember, like, some of his early interviews, like, maybe it was spring 2012, he was completely and utterly just like deer in headlights with Kevin. I think, like, Dylan G would be good at it.
Yeah.
It does seem like those sort of, like, the sort of the craftier.
Yeah, the finesse guys. The
finesse guys seem to be, yeah.
Actually, you know who would be great at it? And that is Mark Cohn. Because, you know, he fits definitely into that finesse category.
There's a lot of finesse there.
But aside from that, you know, like, I feel like I've had more than two or three long discussions about pitching with him based on the idea that, you know, I think I asked him once or twice, like, what, if you weren't a baseball player, what would you do? And he said, I'd be a baseball pitcher, or I'd be a baseball coach. I'd be a pitching coach. And I was like, oh, well, that's interesting. And you like to sort of get into the nuance. And he did. He sort of got into the nuance and really clearly enjoys it, has a passion for it, can really speak to all the different machinations that go on the mound. And, you know, that type of player is really interesting to listen to your point about, you know, the soccer color. Somebody who can speak to what's actually going on out there and capture it. You know, someone who's, you know, obviously we're lucky to have Keith and Ron who can do it really well. But there's another sort of level to that player who's, you know, sort of still on the field, a player who's either is hurt or they're just getting someone on an off day or something. There's something interesting about that, and it's definitely something that I would support.
Another guy, not in the Mets system anymore, I think would be excellent at it, would be Colin McHugh.
Yeah, well, we all know that Colin McHugh is fun to listen to, fun to read, lots of interesting thoughts about on the field / off the field stuff in and around the game. He'd be another really good one.
All right, let's wrap it up, Rob. We went slightly over our 1 hour projection that we made 2 hours ago. That's why you crazy, crazy people keep listening to us. God bless you.
All 12 of you.
All 12 of you. This has been Amazing Avenue Audio, episode 49. We hit the big 50 next week, and we will see you then.